Con mucho cariño para todos ustedes.
Puerto Rico está bien cabrón, ey, está bien cabrón. De Carolina sale el reggaetón y los hijos de putas de Bayamón. Ey, ey, quieren montarse en la ola y no han ido a rincón. Un besito pa' abuela en el balcón, cogiendo todos los hoyos en la Rubicón. P fucking R, ey, tierra de Maelo y Teo Calderón. Y de Baré, el que fue campeón, primero que LeBron. Maldita sea, otro apagón. Vamos pa' los bleachers a prender un blon. Antes que a Pipo le dé un bofetón. Puerto Rico está en cabrón. Ey, estoy en cabrón. Puerto Rico está en cabrón. Ey, ey, ey. Pichea Maldiva. Yo me quedo en Palomino. Ey, si no me voy pa' RD. Un saludo a mis vecinos. Ey, aquí el calor es diferente. El sol está ahí, no. Ey, la capital del perreo.
I hope that you never thought that we would start Green Zine with music from Puerto Rico, from Bad Bunny, but we are. El Apagón, the name of this piece that really broke him to the world back in 2017. And I'm playing this because the translation is the power outage, which continues to be an issue down in Puerto Rico, and we'll discuss that a little bit. And glad to have local conservationist and all-around great writer Mickey Colbeck in the studio with us today. And we'll be having an extended conversation, Henry Swayze, Mickey, and myself in a little bit. But let's bring back up Bad Bunny, and then we'll talk with Henry. We'll get to Bird Note, and then we'll bring Mickey on the air. Piece of music. I wasn't there for the halftime show, either at home or on the radio or anywhere, but I did read about the halftime show, and this taken from a journalist out in California, which one of our previous guests here on the show, Kurt Malin, who's a professor at the Vermont Law and Graduate School, told me about Sammy Roth, and his column, his Substack is called Climate Colored Goggles, and his title piece, Bad Bunny Saves the Super Bowl. Who would have thunk it? He starts off, Sammy Roth, by writing, electric vehicles were nowhere to be found in all those ads. Nope, no EVs, but the electric grid was front and center. And apparently, during the performance, they had kind of had an electric grid set up with poles and wires and dancers and everything. And here's what Sammy says about his experience. In a spectacular halftime show performed mostly in Spanish, the Puerto Rican rapper Benito Antonio Martinez Ocasio, also known as Bad Bunny, sang his song El Apagón, and the translation of that is the power outage, translated damn, another blackout. As he climbed a sparkling electrical pole, dancers jangled from other poles around him, and then various energy nerds on my Blue Sky feed started to freak out. Thank you, Bad Bunny, for highlighting the importance of critical power distribution infrastructure, wrote Costa Samaras, a civil and environmental engineering professor at Carnegie Mellon. Puerto Rico hasn't had reliable power in a decade. The grid sends occasional surges through the wires that fry appliances. Electricity rates are among the highest in the entire U.S. Heat waves are getting intense in the summer, and outages mean AC is no guarantee for an aging population, said journalist Alexander C. Kaufman. If you want to read more and find out more from Sammy here, let me just give you his name again. If you went into Substack and looked up Sammy Roth, S-A-M-M-Y, and last name is R-O-T-H, and I want to get our underwriters acknowledged, and then we'll bring up Henry. The Green Zine is brought to you every week by the Yes We Can Collective. Hey, we just collected $21 the other day from the collective. Very nice. Royalton Memorial Library, the Tunbridge Hill Farm, Chef's Market, and let me give you one more there. Bale, actually two more, Building a Local Economy and Solaflex. We'll mention them again at the end of the show. Going to bring up, make sure I'm staying online. And good morning, Henry.
Good morning.
What did you think? What did you think of El Apagón? Were you dancing up there in Burlington?
Absolutely, it's good stuff. I mean, that's what music does. It gets right through to the nerve tissues in your body instead of which is, this had just the overlay of brain tissue working on the on the subject matter.
Yeah, but interesting. So, I mean, we were just talking about the grid and the price of power here in New England and around the country, but I think it's probably even high. I mean, the highest rates that I saw during our discussion last week from, the fellow from the Renewable Energy Vermont, was in Hawaii and Alaska per kilowatt hour, but I'm guessing that Puerto Rico might even be higher than those two states.
I think it's going to be nip and tuck, and the unreliability of it, the non-existence of it for many people in Puerto Rico is really, I mean, there are people who, since that hurricane, have never had electricity back.
And it wasn't like that hurricane was last year, or even 2 years ago, or even 3 years ago. It's been, what, five, six, 7 years? I don't know, a long time.
Right.
Hmm.
Yeah.
All right,
yeah.
Let's
Puerto Rico's been left to the doldrums. Mm. And you know, and the right, their power line structure is rambling through the hills and underbrush, and it isn't being lines aren't being cleared, and it's not set up to take big hurricanes that knock trees over and things like that, and it'd be expensive to make it right. That's what's driving California's prices up, is they're burying a lot of their lines so they won't start forest fires.
Yeah.
And so here we have a infrastructure which is probably going to stay dicey, or at least not unless a lot of money is thrown at it. And really the way to fix that is to get people set up with local power, with
yeah.
solar panels and batteries, and use the grid when it's there, but not be dependent on it the way
right.
they are now.
Basically, like having a permanent backup power system, which could also be used even when the weather's not bad and lines aren't going down. Well, we're pretty not far enough down that road, and we've talked about it before. But we do have our guests in the studio. But tell us about our bird note before we bring Mickey Kolbeck on the air, Henry.
Well, we should let Mickey Kolbeck tell us about our bird note.
She will as soon as we play it.
Yeah, so let's just listen to it.
Okay.
It's a salute to, especially to Evening Grosbeaks.
All right.
And we'll get into it afterwards.
All right, here we go. Bird Note on Greenzine.
This is Bird Note. The populations of some birds have declined dramatically, more than 80% in the past 40 years. Here are a few. That's the call of the northern bobwhite, a chubby quail that prefers grasslands in the eastern states. That's the song of the evening grosbeak, a robin-sized bird that frequents the boreal forests of Canada and the mountains of the western United States during spring and summer. Northern pintail, slender and elegant ducks, seek shallow ponds and wetlands throughout the northern hemisphere. Common terns migrate along both coasts and through the interior to their nesting grounds in Canada from their winter home in the tropics. This Earth Day, join those who are working to conserve the natural resources that sustain the full community of life for people and birds. You'll find lots of ways to help on our website, birdnote.org. Knowledge, will, and action are the keys. Together, we can ensure that the rich sounds of birds continually join, not disappear from, the Earth's chorus. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Okay, and with that, let's welcome our guest to the studio. Mickey Kolmek, welcome to Green Zine.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here. I feel like I'm with Terry Gross.
Well, I have listened to Terry Gross for, you know, I'm from the Philadelphia area where that show originated back, and I have the type of job where I could listen to the radio all day and certainly have enjoyed. Her career must extend probably a half century. That show's been around
forever.
I think
they just celebrated 50 years.
Did they really just celebrate? That's great.
She's a hero.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was really fun hearing the call of the evening Gross speak because I have been blessed, as a lot of people in the Upper Valley, with flocks of 20, 30, 40 evening grosbeaks coming to the feeders. And they're one of those birds that are normally found up north. But certain things happen, like the spruce budworm can wipe out their cone production in certain years. And so they come down here and there'll be huge flocks of them at our feeders. Something I learned recently was that, they have huge beaks and I would think that they would eat huge seeds, but actually their favorite foods are maple and ash and some of the prunus and mollus seeds, the seeds of apple and cherry. But they really love Acer negundo, the box elder tree, which is kind of a maybe introduced native that grows along the rivers. It's a great tree because it's ugly, but it's really good at stump sprouting. And so the beavers can cut it down every 20 years, and it's like, I don't care. It's like getting a haircut. It stump sprouts, and it helps hold our rivers together. But they love the seeds of the box elder, and we have plenty of box elders along our rivers.
Right, and I think you lived near at least a stream, a river, don't you?
I live on the west branch of the Ompompanoosuck. I live about 30 feet from it, but my house sits way up high on a hill, so it never floods.
Yeah. So you have box elders around where you live?
All along the Ompompanoosuck, there are box elders. Yeah, they're sort of a weedy-looking tree, and people don't usually care for them, but they're quite beneficial to wildlife.
There you go. Well, that's good news.
Yeah.
Henry?
Yeah, I've been looking at bird feeders, and we feed birds up here in Burlington at my partner's house, and we haven't had any evening grosbeaks, but I remember when I first moved to Vermont back in 1965, that next 10 years, I think we saw evening grosbeaks coming to us sometime during the winter, almost every winter. I may be wrong about that, but I think that's what they were.
They have been.
I know more about birds now than I did then. I still only know a little bit about birds. So you might tell us about what does the name grosbeak mean, and if you know, what is an evening grosbeak actually related to in the bird family?
Well, they're a finch, so there's a lot of finches, and gross means big, obviously, and you look at their beak, and it's a big beak. And this reminds me of the story of the Galapagos, the scientist that studied the finches on the Galapagos Islands and actually witnessed evolution taking place over a couple of years when there would be a fire, for example, that would kill off all of the smaller seeds. And the only birds that finches that would survive would be the ones with the big beaks, the gross beaks. But a big beak is an expensive thing to maintain. So over time, the rains would return and the vegetation would return and the smaller seeds would return. And then those finches that had survived that had the smaller finch beaks, they would actually have more offspring and they would become sort of the dominant finch on the island, whereas the bigger beaked finches would be less dominant. So that was a case. There's some great books that were written about this, about the families that lived down there and studied the finches on the Galapagos. But it used to be thought that evolution took a really, really long time, couldn't be witnessed by humans. But they proved that, no, you can see it because of natural selection, because of environmental pressures and natural selection.
Yeah, I think there was a group from one of the colleges that went to that island year after year and observed and figured out the finch population there, and they were thinking, well, we've learned everything we have to learn about it,
And then they had one of these change in weather event, food event, and they got, in just 1 year, they got a big change in the, I think what they were saying were species, but anyway, the size of the beak, and they realized that evolution doesn't have to take hundreds of millions of years.
I'm recalling it was a family named Grant. I may be wrong. It's been a while since I've read the book, but I believe the family was called, their last name was Grant, a husband and wife, and their child.
It may be a separate study. The one the book I'm referring to is called The Beak of the Purple Finch.
The Beak of the Finch. It's called The Beak of the Finch. It's the
You're
same
right.
Beak, yeah.
Right. Finch. No purple.
Yeah.
I agree. All right. So I have a little local thing I just might throw in here. Maybe I have never seen it before. So I live at the end of a dead-end street with steep banks dropping off around this house site. And so we have very little traffic, and those steep banks have a lot of wildlife on them and are really wilderness areas. And we have more different animals in my yard here than I do at the end of 4.5 miles of dirt road in Tunbridge. It's just amazing how many different kinds of wildlife there is here.
Are you in Burlington, you said?
Here in Burlington, and so we have a bunny that we see prints from all the time, and occasionally see the bunny, and we also have a family of gray squirrels, and the gray squirrels work over the ground under where the bird feeders are, picking up seed. And yesterday I saw a bunny picking up those seeds, and a squirrel not liking that the bunny was eating, and the bunny was going up on its hind legs and rotating its feet around in front of him, and I guess getting ready to use its back legs to rake at the squirrel, and the squirrel turned away and let him feed, and it was back and forth, and they were at it for 15 minutes or so. Whose territory is this?
That's interesting. Really, I suspect that your long driveway in Tunbridge has native wildlife. The bunny that you see, the rabbit that you're calling is not a native species. It's not the eastern cottontail. I mean, the gray squirrel is more or less, but I suspect that what you're having in Tunbridge may be more elusive, but it's probably the native wildlife. And what you have up in Burlington is suburban wildlife, and a lot of it's not native. Yeah. But also, Burlington is interesting because it's all sandy soil. That was a huge lake. And like my daughter lives in South Burlington, and their yard's always very sandy and just full of ants because it's a different soil, and it's a completely different ecosystem than what we have here in the Upper Valley.
Yeah. Well, I consider Tunbridge to be my home. I've only been spending time in Burlington for some 15 or 20 years now. And yes, I agree with you completely. And there's a lot of invasive stuff in Burlington, trees and shrubs and all nature of things that they get in the way of nature doing its thing really well. The diversity in nature. All right. Get back to your activities, because
and I want to.
We can ramble for several hours.
Oh yeah, we can do that.
The natural discussion.
Yeah. So what I'd like to do is go back to you. Obviously, have a lot of scientific knowledge, a lot of naturalist knowledge. Mickey, can you take us back to kind of your early adult days and maybe what your major was in college and how you got involved in conservation? And you are, I believe, the conservation chair over in Stratford. And your ongoing interest. And, of course, we will talk about your, I think it's maybe every second or third week, the column that goes in the weekend paper of the Valley News. Once a month. So let's go back in time to those early academic days and your scientific background.
Okay. I grew up in St. Louis, and I was actually an art major at Webster College and got a master's in teaching art. And I taught art for 20 years back in Missouri. I started out in the inner city, and then I went down into the country, like way, way, way down into the boonies in Missouri, and taught a total of 20 years, and then got involved in contra dancing in St. Louis. I met Carl, who was my husband, who passed away about 5 years ago. He was the director of the library here at Vermont Law and Graduate School.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
wow. But yeah. I met him at a contra dance. It was after a wedding, and so one thing led to another, and I ended up moving to Vermont. But I worked as an artist even after coming here and taught school for a while and had a studio and was doing the art show business. And I've always been interested in nature. It's always just been like when I looked at my bookshelves, everything was science and nature. None of it was art. And at some point I said, like, why? What are you doing this? Your passion is really studying nature. And certain things happened, and I ended up going back to school in my 60s. I ended up going back. First, I went to the community college and did an associate's in environmental studies, and I had such a great time going back to school that I went down to Antioch then and did the master's in environmental studies with a focus on conservation biology, and graduated from there in 2018. And I felt like I had finally filled my vessel with the knowledge that I needed, or some of the knowledge I needed. I had the passion to be a conservationist before that, but I didn't really know what to do with the data, you know. And I would hear people around me saying, with full of emotion and passion, but they didn't really understand how to analyze data and how to look at studies. And they would come out with things that were actually not true. And then I felt like that sort of hurt the cause to be like a really emotional environmentalist who gets things wrong. And I didn't want to be that person. I wanted to be the one who could read the studies and actually do studies and figure out what was beneficial. So at that point, then I got on the Conservation Commission and a few years later became chair because nobody else wanted it. And I've really enjoyed it. It's time consuming, but it's really lovely. And we've changed considerably over the last, since 2018. We have a lot of new members now, and we are more of an educational outreach group, I would say, than a political group. I mean, we still get involved in some political things, mm-hmm. We just penned a letter together to the governor and to the Wetlands Rule Committee, because you may be familiar that Governor Scott signed an executive order making it way easier to build an unmapped Class 2 wetlands. So for housing projects. You know, he's under a lot of pressure to build houses.
A lot of pressure, yes.
He thought, well, I can just do this. We can just build in wetter places and nobody will notice. But there was a huge outcry. And conservation commissions all over the state wrote very strong letters. So we did that recently. But I would say our crowning achievement is that every year, around March, we'll sit down and figure out what we're going to do for the year, what hikes we're going to lead, what educational activities we're going to lead. And everybody in the organization either leads a hike or does some sort of crafting with kids with natural fibers or does a river exploration. And this year we're going to actually do a river cleanup on the Ompompanoosuc. We're going to start every year do a section of the river where we just walk down the river and we haul out all the garbage. I think that'll be a lovely thing to do.
It is. And I have participated in that. The Tunbridge Conservation Commission has done that for several years now on the first branch. And those first couple years where nothing had been cleaned out of there, the amount of tires, I forget what year one was, but I think it was 45 or 50 tires. And they were out there again this year. And what's interesting, and maybe you're going to find this in Stratford, that it's a sort of a unexpected team building experience. It's not just that day that your volunteers come out, but some of them may end up being future Conservation Commission members, new people to town. I know a couple of times we went and somebody had just moved to the area in the last 3 months and they didn't live that far away from the first branch, and they came down and got to meet a bunch of people. So real community building experience and important. And hopefully you don't find 50 tires in the Ompompanoosuc.
I don't think we will. I think the river's pretty clean, but we'll get some garbage. It's interesting that you said that about new people to town, because our last four members on the Conservation Commission are new people to town.
Uh-huh.
And I'm really happy about that. Yeah.
I'll bet you are. And how long have you lived over in Stratford?
Going on 30 years.
30 years. And I want to just go one more thing, and I'm sure, Henry, you've got all kinds of questions, but can you describe sort of the natural environment? You mentioned moving way, way down in Missouri. You called it the boonies. What was going on there land-wise and forest-wise, et cetera?
Oh, I just came back. I was there for 2 weeks in October, and I wanted to go back and hike all the places that had helped shape me, that inspired me. So I grew up in St. Louis, which is, you know, it's a city, and it's kind of depleted and polluted. And then I moved down to the country. The first place I moved was, it's an old plutonic, it's a pink granitic pluton called the St. Francis Mountains, Francois Mountains. They're a very, very old mountain range in Missouri and quite worn down. But that's oak and hickory and sharp needle pine.
Mm.
Poor soils, poor sandy soils. And then from there, I was down there about 8 years, and then I moved to Potosi for a teaching job. And Potosi was interesting. That was a mining area where they mined boron. We call it TIF. It's a very white mineral, heavy mineral that's added to a lot of things, including drilling mud. So I lived there for 10 years and taught in the junior high school there. That was, again, oak and hickory, a lot of oak and hickory and pine. An interesting area. And then I moved to another town that was about an hour out of St. Louis, and then to Vermont. Yeah.
Interesting that the trees, what's the word? Not arboriculture, but whatever.
Silviculture?
Silviculture, that's the word. Uh-huh. That's what you're recalling the most in those areas. So hickory sort of maybe making an inroads here in Vermont?
In the southern parts,
in the southern parts of Vermont.
Yeah. I grew up with shagbark hickory and white oak and, well, a million different hickories, but the shagbark were beautiful. And then the white oak were also like my favorite oak. And those are south of here, but they're coming.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been to some symposiums or whatever that talk about that. Henry, you want to take it from there?
Yeah. I would like to hear about your, I think you've done some work on trails and getting people out on walks, and I'm just wondering how that's been received, and are you doing more of it? What's going on there?
So in Stratford, we have 30 miles of hiking trails, and those are almost all due to Mike Hebb, who's on our commission. Mike's really good at finding trails and meeting with landowners and making friendly agreements and then putting trails in that are not invasive. We don't use any machinery to put in a trail, or just they're just really minimal trails, and they wind through a landscape so that you can see beautiful things and not harm, you know, not cause erosion. So we have 30 miles of those trails, and Mike and his team of volunteers, they maintain those trails. And our hikes that we lead, some of them are just like, let's just hike this long, long trail and see what we can see. But most of the ones are actually sort of educational. Like we have the Cobtown Forest, which has a fen, a rich fen that is blessed with all sorts of orchids. We start our hikes there in late May to see the yellow and the pink slipper moccasins. And then in late June, we go back to the other side of the fen to see the ladies ferns, the lady orchids. And there's orchids throughout the year. I mean, they're smaller green orchids, bog orchids there. And so we have hikes that'll be focused sort of on the orchids. And those usually attract a lot of people, sometimes like too many, 20 or 30 people.
Ooh, yeah.
Because it's just a narrow little boardwalk. You know, we'll put them on our listserv. We'll put them on our Facebook page. But so far, it hasn't been a problem. And then Levi Smith is a young naturalist in town. He's only 16 or 17, but he's brilliant. He knows every plant and every animal. And he and I have been leading hikes together just to look at everything else that's growing in the fen and the bog. So we led one or two of those. And then Levi gave a presentation on moths, before the season. We start off the season with a bird walk with Marty Frank, who's now on the board. And then we have a spring ephemeral walk with Kate Bass, who's on the board. She takes people up Taylor Valley, at the end of Taylor Valley, which is a very, very rich biodiverse area.
Yes, it is.
And so they hike up a trail up there and look at the wildflowers, the spring ephemerals. Another one of our members, Erin Younger, lives right on the river, and so she does a river walk. And she studied botany, and she's very much into harvesting plants for teas and foods and fibers. So she leads that walk. So we have a whole variety of walks that tend to be sort of educational. We want to teach you about what you're seeing and why it's growing here, because our thinking is that if people understand what they're seeing, if they know what they've seen, they can identify something and pick it out, they'll be more likely to want to protect that area. So knowledge is actually one of the roots of protecting areas. Our hikes have been well received. We only had one person push back a little bit, thinking he was a little afraid of having like strangers walk all over the land. And we had to convince him that, no, we stay on the trail. We don't let people just go wandering around. We're pretty strict about our hikes. And that if he wanted, we would just ask for his permission or let him know when we were going to hike on his property. And that worked out. We just actually avoided hiking there. There's one hike that Mike and JT Urbach, who's also on the commission, they plan it every year. It doesn't always happen, but it's a border-to-border hike from one end of town to the other. It's a very, very long hike.
Wow.
Completely on the town trails.
5 miles or so?
Oh,
or
it's longer than that. It's a whole day. There's like half of it, and then you break, and then there's the second half. It's a whole day. It's an entire day hike.
What time of year does that happen?
That happens somewhere midsummer.
Okay.
Yeah, we haven't done our schedule yet, but we do. I place the schedule of our hikes on our Facebook page, which is just the Stratford Conservation Facebook page, and then Lisa, the town officer, also puts them on the town website.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing. So that sort of public outreach, and as you said, focus on education. And I like your point about once you have some background knowledge, like let's say you don't know much about ephemerals and you see some, and then maybe you talk to people that like you that are very knowledgeable, or you go home and you look it up on Wikipedia and get a lot more information about it. Then you feel like not only can you discuss it and ask more questions, but as you said, more likely to be sensitive to protection and not go off the trail.
Yes, and not go mudding.
Yeah, no. Well, yeah, we've seen the results of that.
Yeah.
Wow, and I couldn't agree more about the Taylor Valley region being so unique there. And, of course, it does extend into parts of Tunbridge and Verscher as well. I know there's a – and when you mentioned bogs and stuff, I don't know if that was – I know there's an area, we won't name the road, that's over there that has a boardwalk area and a bog up in that area above Taylor Valley. But that is just amazing. Oh, I know. Are you doing any categorization or indexing of vernal pools in Stratford? Are there many vernal pools over there?
There are, and they're not all mapped. But we have Kevin Tolan is the new wetlands person at VCE. He just Steve Fascio retired, and Kevin's taking over the wetlands work. And we're meeting with him in May. He's going to do a 2-hour workshop with us on looking at vernal pools and categorizing them, because some of us have the knowledge and some of us don't, and so it'll be a really good refresher. In fact, I know of one that's up above the homestead. It's not terribly active, but I you know generally see salamander eggs and frog eggs, but I don't think it's ever been mapped. So we could actually do a lot more mapping on vernal pools.
Yeah, and it sounds like you have the people power to do that.
I think so.
pretty strong commission over there.
Yeah, it's good. I'm really. In fact, we have a 10th member this year who's a non-voting member. We just had an extra applicant, and we really liked her, so Margaret Romney. And so we asked her if she would come to our meetings and participate with us, but just not have a vote. She said, sure.
Okay, and you meet once a month?
Once a month. The fourth Tuesday at the town office in Upper Village.
Got it. For you Stratford listeners, yeah. So, go ahead, Henry.
So do you work with any other commissions from other towns?
Conservation Commission?
Well, we have a potluck next Thursday in Thetford with about four other commissions, just a meet and greet. But the answer is actually no. We've been contacted by various conservation commissions sort of far away that want to join together for really big projects, and we've said no because we feel like we're already spread thin and we want to focus locally and not get like spread out into, I don't know, they just seemed out of our reach.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you put a great emphasis on being in touch with nature, with kind of getting people out on the land and understanding it, and that's harder to do when you're working with groups from somewhere else because you're in meetings instead of being out in nature.
Exactly. Then it becomes an administrative thing.
Right, right. You can get carried away. And interesting, in rural Vermont, I think in particular, that, you know, people really pay attention to their towns. I know several people in my town, when I say, oh, we were over in Rochester, we were at some town that was 10 or 12 miles away, and they're like, oh, well, yeah, that's great. But I like to kind of keep track of things, particularly the Herald is very helpful with this, about what is going on with committees in other towns, and actually visit those towns and go to some of the natural resources. For instance, Old City Falls over there. Stratford is a wonderful spot, and some of the hikes mm-hmm. that we've had over there. And you are spot on when you say Mike Hebb does an incredible job with his trails committee there. But yeah, there's so much to do locally that you, as you said, you can get stretched thin and maybe lose sort of sight of what your core objectives are.
Yeah. I agree. I totally agree. Yeah. Yeah. Keep it local.
Shall we shift to Henry? Do you have something else, or should we maybe shift to some of the writing that Mickey has done over the years?
Sure. Go for that. I was, yeah.
So did you have, you know, you told us about your time in Missouri and being a school teacher, mostly in the area of art. So I imagine there wasn't necessarily a whole lot of writing involved in that. But now you've been writing this column in the Valley News for how long, and how did that come around to be, and how have you gotten so comfortable with your nature writing?
It's been 8 years, actually once a month for 8 years. Well, I've always loved to write. At Webster College, I did a lot of writing classes, and I really, really loved it. But it was always like second to my art and to my music. I play a lot of music as well. But about 2018, my husband got sick. And we spent a lot of time just like sitting in the sunroom, cuddling up with the dogs, listening to soft music. And I just started writing. I just started, you know, it became like a cathartic thing to do. And I wrote this piece called What the Sastrugi Taught Me. I had been out skiing, and I kept noticing that these ridges that were forming in the snow were going the wrong way. The wind was coming from the south, but the ridges were as if the wind was coming from the north. And I thought, well, the winds must have been different at night when the ridges formed. And then I went home and did some research and went, no, snow is nothing like sand. Sand, the particles of sand build up, and then it's too much and they drop off. So you have the lee side, the gentle side towards the wind, and the steep side away from the wind. It's the other way around with snow. Sastrugi, the wind carves out the snow and causes these little cliffs because snow sinters. It joins together and is more solid. So I wrote this piece about trust what you see. You know, don't just try and rationalize something away. And I really liked the piece. And I sent it to Marty Frank. And he goes, well, send it to Ernie Kotatz. He's the editor at the Perspectives on the paper. So I sent it to Ernie. And he goes, oh, I like this. I'm going to put it in on Sunday. And so he put it in on Sunday. And then I thought, well, this is really easy. I can be a writer. So I started writing and sending him like all kinds of stuff. And he goes, whoa. How about just once a month? I got all these other people I need to filter in. And then he said, well, if you're going to be doing this, why don't you come by and have a picture made? And then you need to think of a name, a title. And so at the time, I was really active with an internet group called Lichens, Mosses, Ferns, and Fungi, which is a Facebook group of, you know, quirky people that like those things. Yeah. And I put it out there like, hey, I need to come up with a name. And somebody thought of Proust, Un Promeneur Solitaire, like, what about a solitary walker? And I went, that sounds good, because I generally just go walking alone with me and the little brown dogs. So I used that. And then I started writing pieces once a month, and it's been going on for 8 years.
Wow. So I think your next piece is, what, about a week away, 2 weeks away?
Well, I never know exactly.
Oh, okay.
I write a piece and I submit it, and it depends. Alex Hansen was the editor for about a year or two, and he was really good about getting back to me and saying, oh, I read it, I like it, let's do these changes, but I shouldn't say anything about
this. No. Yeah, yeah.
He's the only editor I've had at the paper that actually did that.
Okay,
so,
yeah, we know Alex.
And actually, they're so stretched thin there that I'm just grateful that they even put it in there. But I don't hear it back now. It just goes in whenever it goes in.
Well, it's interesting. When it goes in, it's usually in the weekend perspective section.
Yeah.
And these dark days that the country is experiencing politically, often there's an editorial about ICE or about the administration, et cetera, kind of, oh, boy, I don't know. Uh-huh. And then there's your column out with the LBDs enjoying the Ompompanoosic or snowshoeing or something like that. It's such an antidote to some of the other news, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Although this one that may be in on Saturday, it is about nature. It is about skiing with the dogs back in the soft powdery snow, but it ends up talking about politics. In fact, my sister scolded me. She said, Mickey, don't do that. You won't be safe.
Oh, no, right. They're going to track you down.
Well, she lives in a big city somewhere, and she said, don't do that. She said, I know you're safe in Vermont, but I really worry about you getting, you know, being outspoken about politics. Yeah. But this one, if it is in on Saturday, it does end. I talk about the monks, and I talk about the people in Minnesota just a little bit as being being so hopeful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well,
you know, when you're out in the snow, or you're out enjoying the trees, or you're out there with the Conservation Commission on a hike, or you're getting down cleaning up the Ompompanoosic, that means you're not doom scrolling. You're out doing something that's really optimistic and connecting to nature, which we bring up on the show fairly often. Henry's a real specialist in that. He's kind of the country mouse, city mouse up there in Burlington, but his place here in Tunbridge is pretty remote.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I agree. Being out in nature and letting go of the little voices and just looking, just hearing. You know what I heard this morning when I went out into the yard to fill the feeders? It was the first time that the chickadees were singing and the titmouse was singing. It was actually, the males were actually doing their territorial song.
Oh.
And there were a bunch of them, and this is the first time. So I think spring is coming soon.
Yeah, yeah, not far away.
Wow, that's very positive.
It is, yeah.
You know, we up in Burlington, we're usually 2 weeks ahead of what I see at Tunbridge, and I don't think I've heard any singing yet from our. I mean, we certainly have chickadees and nuthatches galore here.
I think you will soon, Henry, because you're
maybe I haven't opened my ears. Yeah. I might say that I have looked at the. At the snow and the patterns in the snow, the drifts, as I would like to call them, and you have educated me because I couldn't figure out why they were going the wrong direction.
Oh, lovely! That makes me so happy.
I assumed that it was because the wind had shifted; otherwise, it wouldn't be like that.
Yeah, that's what I did.
And now I know better.
Yeah.
So, thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm going to put, go ahead, Henry.
I want to go back to the Conservation Board writing the governor about wetlands. Do you think that has, I realize this is politics, but what do you think will become of that? Do you think that he'll back off from that altogether, or do you think they'll try to come up with some sort of a compromise arrangement in order to get more building to happen?
Well, I think he's enough of a populist that if there's enough of a pushback, which I think there has been, that he'll moderate that aspect of it. Like we said, he's under a lot of pressure to build. And I think what maybe has been happening is somebody comes up with an idea for a project and they get ready, they start drawing up plans, and then somebody does a little bit of digging and goes, oh, wait, you can't build here because even though it's not mapped, this is actually a Class 2 wetland. And they're quite common. So I think it was his effort to just take away one of the roadblocks to building. But I don't know what's going to happen because we do have a lot of Class 2 wetlands, and they're important. They filter our water. They hold they hold heavy rains and release it slowly. But we do need places to build as well. Out of the floodplain, up a little bit in drier places. We just need to really search better. And I think our building needs to be closer to our villages, which are already, you know, they're already not good for wildlife. So let's just keep our building as close as we can to villages, but like up a bit.
Yeah, and that's kind of a real, you know, not a paradox, but it does. There's a conflict there in that a lot of, particularly in this area and other parts of Vermont, the villages are on tributaries, on brooks, etc. But if you go too far up into the hill, then you're on, maybe you're on prime ag land and there are restrictions there. I know Act 250 has been tweaked in the last couple of years and really focusing on the villages. So we'll have to see. There are a lot of nonprofits working in Montpelier who maybe oppose any development near Class 2 wetlands. It seems to me that with, as you mentioned, mapping where they are and being very careful and more sensitive, but not just kind of taking a sledgehammer and just saying, oh, well, you know, it doesn't really matter where they are because they're really, you know, not that sensitive. And that's the best place for the developer to build. But I guess that's going to, I don't know if they'll resolve that during this session or whether this is a longer discussion up in Montpelier or not.
I'm listening to, it's a listening session on Zoom tonight for all of conservation people. And it's on mapping and it's on the 30 by 30 project. So I'm hoping to learn more tonight.
Yeah. We've have a regular list, a couple of regular listeners who mentioned the 30 by 30. And I know there's a bill that's going to expand, I think, about working lands being included in that 30 by 30. Does your commission have a perspective on whether that's a good idea to get us to 30 to 30 by 30 faster, but maybe in not such a, maybe a little higher carbon footprint way? I don't know.
It's not something we've actually discussed. I could just speak for myself that I feel like, you know, agricultural lands are very, very important. The forested lands, the interior forest block, the wildlife corridors, and the prime agricultural lands need to be protected and not built on. That they're very important. The problem with Vermont is, like, it's all so beautiful. It all has value somewhere. It's like, it's really hard to know where to build because everywhere you look is something that's beautiful and could be preserved. That doesn't sound like a conservationist, but it is. It's a quandary. It's a quandary.
The big wilderness area. Just turn it back into a big wilderness area. Get rid of the people.
Well, that's, yeah, that doesn't work either.
No, I'm just teasing.
I know.
But it is a...
Well, what is interesting, though, with our natural resources, and at least with climatologists' prediction that that precipitation, that we're not necessarily going to dry out really soon, that we have seen a lot of climate refugees over the last few years. I don't know if that's going to increase and put more pressure on additional housing or not, but also that if there was a whole lot of, let's say, not very organized housing built, that it will start to degrade what kind of is one of the ethos of Vermont, is being a very prime environmental small state, but really prized for its environmentalism, its natural resources. Obviously, it helps drive the tourist industry year round. So, yeah, it's a real juxtaposition there.
Yeah. I heard Scott say something interesting about, he's against this long driveway rule that they're proposing.
Yes, 800 foot, yeah.
Yeah, he said, well, you know, my driveway's, and people do that. They'll say, well, I do this, and it's not a problem. So therefore, it should be okay. But, you know, that doesn't wash. What happens if you put in a long driveway, then things follow. You can look at maps over time in wilderness areas. You get a little road, then you get a longer driveway, then you get little shoots off it, then you get more houses, and then eventually it's just like suburbia. But that's how suburbia grows, is starting with the little driveway that becomes a longer driveway that becomes, you know, becomes suburbia over time.
There's an area in Tunbridge that I'm aware of, and a real estate local real estate developer sold a parcel of land that was, you know, basically not serviced by a Class 4 road, and pushed pretty hard to turn it into a Class 4. I'm not sure what the status of it was, but I think we were skiing out there a few years ago. We could see where the lot was, and thinking there's more potential lots along here. And it leads from Tunbridge over into a part of Sharon. But that sort of, well, you know, give them an inch, you'll take a mile, and maybe more than 800 feet. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a creeping development thing that we certainly need to keep an eye on.
And that brings up the roads into wilderness. This is national, but there are rules for many of the national forests and so forth areas that are no new roads, and that's being attempted to be taken down on a national level. And that's certainly what happened to the Amazon in the rainforest. When you build a road in, then there's illegal logging, and then there's legal logging, and then there's gold mining or whatever with, you know, that turns that from a diversified natural forest into wasteland that humans have extracted the natural resources from.
Yeah, you mentioned climate change and human refugees, but also there's plant and animal refugees. So as the climate changes further south, then there are species that will need to migrate up. And I just learned about a project that the Nature Conservancy is doing called the Southern Greens to the Whites. It's sort of trying to maintain a corridor for this migration, which actually starts around Sharon and Stratford and goes up through and then ends up over into the White Mountains. And it's, I guess they're trying to help conserve land on this corridor because it, in order to be a corridor for migration, you have to be quite varied. You have to have a variety of elevations, a variety of soils, a variety of hydrology, because you have so many different plants that have so many different, and animals that have so many different needs, that these areas that are rich for migration are areas like Taylor Valley and Sharon and Stratford, and then all the way across up into the Whites, because they have all this variety.
Yeah.
Well, wow, that's interesting that you need that variety of terrain, of soils and so forth within that to make it work as well. Makes sense.
It does make sense.
Back away and think of it. Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, Todd, shall we move on to?
Yeah, I think we should. Now, when your outdoor events, I think you said planning coming up in March and all the different walks and things like that, and not to get, are they open to people who live outside of Stratford? Do you have a sign up ahead of time, or it's just whoever shows up on the day of the event? And we don't want to over promote you know, we've got sensitive natural environments out there, so.
You don't have to sign up. They're free. They're open to anyone. The orchid walks draw a lot of people from far away. At this point, it's not been a problem of having them be too big. But so we'll deal with that if it happens.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Right now, okay. They're open to everybody.
All right. We'll maybe only tell our closest friends if there's if there's an orchid walk coming up.
Okay.
I think our listenership won't tilt you too badly.
I think your listenership are the people that come on our walks.
Yeah. So I want to issue an advance invitation. So something that we didn't really get deeply into is a lot of the content that's in your writing, in your columns. Maybe in the future we have another talk show that is called Wordstream, where we talk to local writers, journalists, novelists, poets, etc. Maybe we could get you back on the air for an episode of that in the future.
Sure, talk about writing.
Yeah,
how I write and how I edit and when it feels like it's finished.
All right, I will be in touch, folks. You have been listening to the chair of the Stratford Conservation Commission and involved in all kinds of things, Mickey Colbeck, and it's so great to have you here on Green Zine.
Thank you so much, Todd and Henry. This has really been fun.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Excellent. Thanks. Yep. Thank you for joining us, and you're welcome to stay on and kibitz on our wrap up at the end of the last 7 minutes of the show.
Yeah, we jump around for a lot of different things that we've been kind of gathering over the previous week. So I'm going to turn Mickey down in the mix, and Henry, I'm going to some of the other news that Sammy Roth has in his Substack column here. Other than, of course, the Bad Bunny song about the ongoing power outages in Puerto Rico. Just little tidbits here. He's calling it the Trump Report. We tried not to say that name during the show, but he wrote it. The Trump administration is on the verge of overturning the endangerment finding. Yeah, we know about that from our friends at Standing Trees, which allows the federal government to regulate greenhouse gases as pollutants. And that's a story that was in the New York Times. He also notes that a judge ruled that the Trump administration's fake climate science panel violated federal law by flouting transparency rules. Well, that's a real surprise. A new poll finds that more than half of right-leaning voters support large-scale solar, which, of course, our president doesn't agree with. Just a couple more here. It's not just federal land. The Trump administration is blocking hundreds of wind and solar farms on private property. Another story from the New York Times. And finally, offshore wind is getting all the attention, but a combination of local opposition, disappearing tax credits, and the Trump administration's refusal to grant permits has caused onshore and offshore wind to grind to a halt. Now, some of that has been counteracted by many court rulings that have allowed the final construction of some of those offshore wind. Why don't we stick with power, Henry? I think you had some updates on...
Yeah, I have a couple of things. So that endangerment clause,
yes,
the powerful fossil fuel lobby has been hiding behind the fact that the government was in charge of regulating. And if that endangerment clause gets removed, then the burden falls directly on them, and they can't hide behind the fact that the EPA was supposed to be regulating this. And they're having very cold feet about seeing that struck down, because they think it'll open up to a lot of court activity, which they're getting already.
Hmm.
Okay, just a sidebar on that one. So last week we got into a mention that the governor would like to do atomic power. And I have put in the show notes an item on the problem with waste, and dug in some into dry cask storage and what happens to that over time, and just how lethal is spent fuel rod waste. And then, let's see.
Well, while you're looking
clock up, so I see what we're looking at. Okay, you got 3 minutes.
Yep.
So I'll steer you to that, and then also, there's quite a lot of information that I pulled together, some very interesting YouTubes on fission, to do with Helion building their site and how they're doing fusion, and then going on to another company that that's started up to want to do fusion because they came from the effort to put satellites and rockets into orbit and realized that we're not going to be able to explore space and take humans to space very much if we didn't have fusion power, because it just isn't enough chemical launch material available on Earth to do it, or enough money to pay for it. So they in their video, a 18-minute piece, runs through all the different kinds of methods of making fusion work and what the upsides and downsides of each one is. But fusion can generate a little bit of radioactive material. It has a nice short half-life of maybe 12 days if they're generating it. Our fission power plants that we're used to have a half-life out around 24,000 years, and that's still half the nuclear activity left over for the next 24,000 years.
Right. And real quick on the fission side, Henry, and I'll try to get you a clip of this recent meeting that was held at the Vermont Law and Graduate School about small modular reactors, which is being pushed all around the country for data centers and other reasons. And it was attended by Earl Hatley, Paul Gunter, Arne Gunderson, and Deb Katz. And I believe that Zoom meeting was taped. A lot of information. I'll try to get that over to you. Thank you very much, Mickey. Thank you, Henry. We're going to give one last shout out to our underwriters here, and it'll be time for Democracy Now! Green Zine. It's been brought to you by Solaflect, Bale, Tom Wells, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, Wit and Grit, and the Yes We Can Collective. We'll see you next week on WFVR-LP, South Royalton, Vermont.